Hi, and welcome to Getting a Medieval, a podcast where I talk about medievalism in pop culture, except for today. Today, we are talking to one of my good friends, Dr. Carolyn Au Outlaw, in a new series, a bonus series, that is about actual medieval studies. Not that medievalism isn't a medieval studies. We've had that conversation. Go see episode one, where Sarah and I talk about that for like an hour and a half. So today we are going to talk about archaeology in medieval Ireland. But first, let me introduce Carrie. Carrie, hello.
Hi Josh, thanks for having me. So just really quick about who I am, what I study. As you mentioned, I study Irish archaeology, so very broad. I'm currently in the commercial sector, so literally have to deal with every time period. And my PhD research was actually very diachronic as well, so looked at from the earliest people in Ireland and then through to early modern period. So definitely looked at the late medieval there as well. And so I'm really excited to talk about kind of what makes Irish medieval studies kind of unique, what's interesting there, and how archaeology, how we look at things a little bit, which might be a bit different from what a lot of people are used to.
Right. So, for those of you that are regular listeners, if you listen to last episode, Ian and I talked a lot about why certain things in medievalism, so like Viking movies, are often very textile based because of the way we have certain kind of European people's history, whether it's through like textile stuff, art, architecture rather than actual like written evidence and works. But before we get into that, I do want to talk about or ask you about what does commercial sector mean in terms of archaeology?
Okay, so in the United States, it's actually called cultural resource management.
Okay.
Here, it's literally just called commercial archaeology. So it's a field of archaeology that aims to protect, usually through record. So we go in and record what we can before infrastructure and buildings and things destroy it. So before roadworks or new high rises, well, not so much the high rises here, but before any sort of digging goes on, first we do an assessment to make sure that there's nothing, already protected on the land. Ireland has some of the strongest protections of archaeology in the world, really.
Wow,
So
really?
every single time somebody wants to dig into the ground, an archaeologist has to say whether or not they think there might be archaeology. Usually we say probably, simply because, I mean, really. And then we'll go out, and if they're digging, we might monitor the dig just to see if anything comes up, and then we say, hey, stop. If it's super important, we have to say you're going to need to move. Or if it's something that we feel we can get enough research out of just by recording it then and there, we might let it continue. But there's also a lot of times we will completely excavate out a site before the development occurs. So that's kind of where I am. I do a lot of the assessment stage. So do a lot of historical background, any sort of past archaeological work that's been done in the area, cartographic research, that kind of thing for any of the development companies that want to come in and potentially alter or destroy archaeology.
Okay, so that's something that, because I remember, okay, for full a disclosure, Karen and I have been friends for a very long time. And we went to undergrad together. And I was there when you were a baby archaeologist. And now you're so grown up. I got your PhD
To be fair,
before me.
Ireland does a 4-year PhD.
God,
The
that's so
United
nice.
States does a
125,000
infinity
year.
year
You're
PhD.
just
So
never
it is a
done.
little bit different.
But and I'm so proud to call you doctor. But anyway, before I go out and make this very gushy, So, and most of my audience at this point are people who have like a passing interest. And a lot of these like terms or facets of like archaeology and stuff is not something we really know, but it's really cool to see that it's such a prevalent thing in Ireland. But why do you think that is? Like, why do you think you like there's so much need for an archaeologist to come through every time someone is building something?
To be fair, I don't think the need is unique to Ireland. It's
Right.
just
True,
that
true.
the protective measures are unique to Ireland.
Yes.
So Ireland is actually quite a relatively new country. Gained its independence in the early 20th century. And so they had this kind of opportunity to create new laws in kind of a more modern world, whereas some of the older countries, such as the United States, which
Right.
and a lot of European countries are laughing at the fact that I just called the United States a
Right.
country. But comparatively speaking, it
Right.
is. They went into this saying, what do we want to do in with a 20th century mindset? And one of the things they did was the National Monuments Act of 1930. Recently, actually 2023, we have a new Heritage Act, which is really
Nice.
exciting. Up until now, it's just been amendments to the 1930 Act.
Right.
But part of that act and all the amendments and everything was a very kind of focus in on we want to protect our heritage. Because obviously, when nation building at that stage, heritage is a really big thing.
Yes.
When trying to create a national identity, you often turn to the historical and archaeological records of, okay, where are we coming from? Who are we as a people? Where do we want to go as a people? And so heritage was obviously very much in that mindset, and they just have created some of the strongest heritage laws in the world.
Nice. I mean, I definitely think that the US could 100% use. Yeah. Like, because you, when you were doing your bachelor's here in the States, there's not any, I mean, I'm sure there's like maybe something archaic on the books, but nothing that really protects our.
Well, we have the states has really good protection on,
That's good.
say, Native American.
Yeah.
Archaeology has NAGPRA, which is a great step in the protection of Native sites and Native cultural heritage. And there are especially different cities
Right.
and kind of counties and areas
Yeah.
like that might have more protection than others. So there's just not a blanket kind of
Yeah.
every single development has to be looked at. Different states have different regulations on the
Right.
ownership. So here in Ireland, every single piece of cultural heritage is owned by the people and therefore the responsibility of the state. So
Interesting.
if you have a farm that has a ring fort, it's a type of archaeological
Right.
monument usually associated with the early medieval period here, you have a legal right to protect that monument because it belongs to everyone, because it's everyone's heritage.
That's really
So
interesting.
again, it's a different mindset.
Yeah.
It's yes, you own the land,
Right.
which is what obviously that would be the where the period comes at the sentence in
Right.
a lot of areas of the states. But there's also kind of this, at least legally,
Right.
there's this idea that everyone owns the cultural heritage. So
Got
that really helps a lot with the protection. And that's why it doesn't matter who owns the land, if there's a
it.
big development happening, archaeologists have to come in.
Right. I have a friend who does early American history, and they've come into issues because every like county will have a different kind of rule and regulation. And so you have to figure out, okay, does that county match what I'm doing here? Can we get things transferred? And it is just, a lot of times it's just a mess that stalls
Well,
academic
and
progress.
one great advantage Ireland also has is that it's very tiny.
Yeah, it's very small.
So it's much easier to do an overarching federal law in a place that's the roughly the size of South Carolina
Right.
rather than a place that's larger than the continent I'm on.
I truly think sometimes when we're talking about countries, especially like that's not like Canada or Mexico, Europe, the size of Europe seems very abstract when we realize just how small Europe is in comparison to the US. And so I think we don't really realize like it is a lot easier for Ireland because it's so tiny, whereas the United States has Texas. And I literally could just end it with has Texas or California. And just that alone is massive. But enough about America. We are not talking about America. We're talking about the medieval era. So I want to go back to Ireland as an interesting place for archaeology. So we already talked about the heritage site. So in your words, what is, oh, I'm going to really pitch on the spot. I'm sorry. What is the most interesting aspect of your work? Like, what do you love more than anything else?
I'm gonna maybe insult some medievalist here,
I'm so
but I'm
excited.
actually a prehistorian at heart.
Yeah.
So I really love especially the Mesolithic in Ireland. So Ireland is quite unique in that it was not settled until about 10,000-ish years ago. So there is some potential Paleolithic evidence coming up in Ireland.
Oh, that's exciting.
And so we have a peer-reviewed bare patella with butchery marks on it from Clare, a cave in Clare. And there's a reindeer bone, I believe, from a cave in Cork that I don't know. No one cite me on this. I'm not sure if it's peer-reviewed yet, but it's by the same investigator. So that's kind of our most compelling Paleolithic evidence at the moment. But Ireland was covered by an ice sheet for a lot longer than, a good a lot of places in Europe. And it also once humans kind of were coming this way, there also wasn't a land bridge of any kind between Ireland and Britain or France. There were, little tiny islands that no longer exist, but you'd have to basically hop on a boat and hope for the best, which is possible, and which could be how we got, our bear patella and reindeer bone. But really, the Mesolithic, about 10,000 years ago, so the Middle Stone Age, is when we really start getting people here. And I really love kind of looking at pre-agricultural societies and what drove the introduction of agriculture. Again, because it's an island, we it out external pressures are kind of obvious for, compared to other places. And so and I'm my PhD was coastal resource use. It was focused on what are called shell middens or mounds of shells deposited after the use of shellfish. And so there's actually a lot of great research focused on the Mesolithic in shell middens, and kind of what we can learn from coastal interactions, coastal resource use, which eventually there's somebody right now who's done a lot of work in the transition into that agricultural society of the Neolithic or the New Stone Age. And they're also looking at shell middens for that transitional period. So there's kind of it's a unique environment given that it does have kind of a later settlement period than most of Europe, and it's an island. So you get like the interactions along the coastline are incredible. But they're also not quite as slap in your face as the Mediterranean.
Well, yeah, but
So, it's unique in that way. But also going into the medieval Ireland, kind of,
yeah.
it's also really fun. We get the early medieval. I know, I think we're focusing on the late medieval today, but the early medieval starting around 400 AD here in Ireland, we get a unique writing script that's only found here, Wales, and Scotland, but primarily here, called Ulm.
Right, right.
And so that's, it's kind of a very unique, it's not necessarily that they felt that they wanted to write a bunch of prose. They didn't want to write their memories down. They didn't want to, you know, write their stories down, but they still kind of went, we could write some things. How about we put our name on this stone? And created their own script. And then you get some absolutely stunning artwork and, you know, and illuminated manuscripts, such as the really famous Book of Kells and everything.
Right, right.
And that kind of art form and is insular art.
Oh.
And because it's based in the islands, primarily
that makes sense.
In Ireland, but also a little bit in Britain, we'll admit it. but Ireland in particular had a really strong aesthetic that's kind of uniquely theirs during, especially the early medieval period, but also really flourishes in the late medieval period as well, as in metalwork, in their illuminated manuscripts. And there's also kind of the idea of, this is putting it quite strongly, but the Irish, how the Irish saved civilization. I don't know if you've heard of that term.
Yes.
But it's this
I've
idea.
Heard of that.
Ireland never had a dark age. So
really?
The plague and all of that stuff actually meant a resurgence in Gaelic culture in Ireland, because the Anglo-Normans had their own problems.
Right. Frequently,
and
yeah.
So kind of there was this basically continuation of, again, that manuscript recording
Right.
and the arts and all of that, because they didn't really have all of the major problems that were that most of the continent was having during what we consider kind of the late medieval period.
Yeah.
So again, Ireland's really unique throughout history. I may be more of a prehistorian, but I mean, the medieval is still really cool, because they still get to do their own thing, you know, and
Yeah.
they hold on to so many, and a lot of people do, but
Right, of course.
From what I know, the traditions of the Irish are so rooted in their past, and you can see that, especially with going from kind of the Iron Age culture, incorporating Christianity for the first time in the early medieval, and then creating a uniquely insular Christianity that still kind of holds on even with the reforms of the late medieval. So, you know, people from the continent come over and go, you know, Rome says we should be doing that, this. And they're like, yeah, okay. But also we're going to keep doing this
Right.
for a little while. So yeah, Ireland's a really unique place, and it's a great, great place to study. All of the different periods.
Yeah, it's always like whenever I'm doing anything with my own research, especially if it's Arthurian, Ireland is always mentioned as kind of like this weird other. Sometimes it's like a pagan other. And when they're talking about like it being a pagan other, it's not really like they're worshiping the old Irish gods as much as it is they're doing a weird form of Christianity that England doesn't like. And so they're going to call it weird and pagan and bad. But it's always just like, Ireland is over here in the mist. Ooh. And it's also kind of that way when, like, whenever they start talking about like the Norse, although with the like old English and the Norse, it's very much like, oh no, the Vikings are coming. We're going to all die. Which is where, like, I've kind of sit. So it's really interesting to kind of hear you say all the stuff about Ireland after, like, I've just wrote a big part of my dissertation and was arguing about Galahalt being Irish, which he is in some works. But they also referred a lot of times, with Scotland and Ireland. Can you stop? Sorry, my cat is deciding to like try to tear up the door to get in because he's mad that he's not allowed in when I am recording. I was talking about Ireland, Scotland. Right. So a lot of times when like the like English or the French are talking about the Celts, they'll start lumping together most of them, especially the French do that a lot. And like ooh, scary. And really, I think it's stemming from this one kind of sounds like jealousy to me, but that's another, but I'm also half Irish and I could just be being an ass. But also, I think it really stems from, like you said, like they had their own very insular way of doing things, which is not what the continent was doing at the time. But I want to actually, and I know that this is supposed to be a medieval studies podcast, and however, this is also my podcast. So I kind of want to hear more about your work with the prehistoric. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I kind of want to hear a little bit more about it.
Well, how about I give you a little bit more about my actual PhD,
Okay,
and
cool.
that'll go because obviously, as you're aware, PhDs are very niche. So, as I mentioned, I studied shellmittens, and yes, they are a great source of looking at the Mesolithic and into the Neolithic, so that pre-farming into the that farming kind of idea. But in Ireland and really everywhere, but with my research, I looked at every single shellman that's ever been recorded in Ireland.
Oh, wow.
And so that was 800 something sites or 800 something deposits over 500 something sites.
Wow.
And we have about, we, Ireland has over 7,000 kilometers of coastline. So honestly, I was expecting more.
Right.
And there's some geographical, like, why is there a blank here? But when you look at the dates, yes, there's a lot of the date to the Mesolithic. Then there's kind of a little fall off, especially in kind of the late Neolithic into the early Bronze Age. Then the Bronze Age, it just goes crazy. Actually, I think I have, yeah, I don't know why I think I have. I know.
I was like, you know what? I hope you know, but I'm just gonna let you go for it.
most of the or excuse me, the highest number of shellmans dated to the different periods are Bronze Age.
Oh.
And then so farming is very well and settled in Ireland, but they go, oh wait, we have a coast. Why don't we go and do use that? And then
Surprised.
kind of into the Iron Age is very tricky in Ireland. We won't get into that here because I could go all day about the difficulties with dating the Iron Age and finding the Iron Age in Ireland. There's plenty of papers and PhDs on that if you're interested. But then into the early medieval and late medieval, there's again a lot of specifically early medieval, but also there's not like a drop off in the late medieval
Right.
with the deposition of shells along the coast. And they start to be found a lot of times around Christian sites. And this is, I'm pretty sure, due to the fact that obviously on fast days, you can't have meat, which is defined as land meats, and you
Oh,
can have seafood. And
which
there's some stories about them coming up with all sorts of things that, well, this is seafood because. So you had barnacle geese are seafood because they believed that barnacle geese were born of goose barnacles, and barnacles
okay,
are from the sea.
right.
So you can eat the geese because they're born of the sea.
I love a creative justification for things.
And
I
all sorts of seabirds, you might as well eat them, you know.
Right, because they're born of the sea. I get it. I'm right there with
Yeah,
them.
I mean, it's funny with the goose barnacles and barnacle geese. So barnacle geese are actually Migratory, obviously. So they don't hatch in Ireland. So they leave, I think, for Canada, where they
Oh.
hatch, and then they'll come back here for the winter and all that stuff. So when you just, they seem to just magically appear, and goose barnacles, if you look at them, actually do kind of look like geese just hanging off of, like,
Hold
shipwrecks and things. And so they went, obviously, they're just sprouting out of the barnacle. We've never seen them hatch. We've never seen them lay eggs. They just sprout out of the barnacle.
Okay, they do kind of look, yeah, no, they do kind of look like
You're
geese.
looking it
I'm
up?
not, yeah, I
Yeah,
did look it
they
up.
do. there's some great illuminated illustrations of that myth as well. So yeah, looking at the medieval side of things for me was focused on kind of why are they still doing something that a lot of people still in archaeology think Shellman's, oh, Mesolithic,
Yeah.
done. Because once farming goes in, why do you need to
Right.
deposit all these shells? Why are you doing that? So it was very interesting kind of getting into the why are they still doing it? What would cause this? And now they're not necessarily huge deposits at this point.
Right.
They're very much seem to be very concentrated, maybe on pilgrimages and things. Which pilgrimage especially becomes huge in the late medieval. And that's, I think,
Right.
a
Yeah.
continental thing as well.
Yes.
We had Irish people going to the Santiago de Compostela and all
Right.
sorts of continental pilgrimages, but also local ones. They'd go to the early medieval sites where Saint Patrick was, or Saint Columbkill, or Saint Ciarán, or
Right.
all
Everybody's
sorts
going on
of.
a pilgrimage.
Most of the saints aren't considered Roman Catholic saints. Saint
Interesting.
Bridget and all those.
Yeah.
So they go to these places, and that's where you find little deposits of shells from potentially they visited the place and said, I need dinner for the night. I'll pry off some limpets, get some of these winkles, boil them over a fire. There you go, there's dinner while you're visiting the site. Because if you're going on a pilgrimage, you're obviously probably fasting or doing some
Right.
other sort of
Right.
focus on God. And yes,
And so
I
for
actually have
even.
one quote from I think it was late medieval priest who talks about basically even outside of fasting, he felt that fishing was closer to God than hunting.
That is a really interesting quote. And I know at least 17 people back home that would agree wholeheartedly with
Hey,
that
I'm a
quote.
pescatarian, so I'm right there.
Exactly.
Let's see. Nope.
Huh.
I don't know the right search.
So thinking about, well, I mean, pilgrimages is always something that comes up constantly again and again and again in medieval literature. But now thinking specifically about the way food culture works in terms of archaeology is really interesting because I mean, think we could always learn a lot about people through what they eat, what they were eating on the road, what they were having in their halls, what kind of meat, what kind of ale, what kind of wine they were serving. And this is a very janky transition. sorry, audience, but you get what you get. You get what you pay for. You're not paying for this, so that's all I have to say. Unless you subscribe to my Patreon, which I don't have yet, but I will, and then you should subscribe. I don't get higher quality things. Oh, note on the quality of the audio right now. Brief aside, I am not at my usual studio because this spring break, thus the university studio is closed. So. I'm at home using my good old Yeti and my air conditioner, which is on because I don't want to sweat. So sorry if you hear noise. But earlier, before we got on, we talked about the message back and forth about architecture. Do you want to talk a little bit more about Irish architecture? It could be a medieval, it could be pre. It's up to you. I'll leave it up to you.
We'll talk medieval.
Okay.
So Yeah, obviously one of, well, I looked a lot at kind of more of the food side of things. Not saying that shellfish were exclusively food because they weren't, but yeah, I did look at that a little bit more. There's some really interesting architectural shifts throughout, obviously, the time. And this isn't unique to Ireland. Everywhere has architectural
Of
shifts,
course.
you know. But so the church in particular obviously influences a lot of architectural changes. So in the early medieval, you start getting kind of some of our largest stone constructions, and they're church-based. Obviously, the first monasteries that came in the 5th, 6th century would have started as wooden, but eventually they would have replaced with the more permanent stone structures that we still have standing today. But one of the great things about those is they actually have what are called skeuomorphs, which are basically a holdover of wooden architectural needs as an aesthetic in the stone structure. So the shape of the door or the ante columns, so at the kind of front where the wooden I don't want to say logs because that's incorrect, but we're going to go with logs for now because I can't remember the correct word, would stick out. They often would have their stones stick out in the front on the corners. The famous Celtic crosses that have the circular bits going around that often have large circles kind of where say halo intersects the cross. Those large circles are where there would have been large nails connecting the different pieces of the wooden cross. So kind of you see, while we don't obviously have any of the wooden structures remaining, we do have some of the architectural features that you're looking at going, why would they do that in stone? That's not necessary. It's a holdover.
It's a
Because,
holdover.
yeah. And obviously, you know, the earliest churches were on paper trying to emulate the original Temple of Jerusalem. Obviously, this was, you know, not necessarily happening. And so if that's what you picture the true Christian church supposed to look like, then you're wanting to, you know, even if you're doing it out of stone, you want it to continue to look like that.
You want to have some kind of
Yeah,
continuity
exactly.
with it.
We also have an interesting structure in early medieval. So really quick, sorry for the digression, but really quick, when I say early medieval in Ireland, I'm talking from 400 to, a lot of people say 1169. We might get back to that date later. And then late medieval would be around 1169 to about 1500. So that's roughly when we start getting into the post-medieval world there. So in this early medieval period, we have obviously, I just talked about the church itself. And in the monasteries, they would have been surrounded by usually two or more enclosures. And this kind of had a, as you got closer and closer to the church, it was more and more sacred. And so obviously your lay people would set up their stuff at the outskirts, and then the monks and everything would have their living spaces, and you know, the sacristy and everything would be in the very center of the enclosures. So enclosure is just a big wall, round wall. And so inside of these enclosures, you in the interior of the enclosures, you'd also have what are called round towers, which again are very, very Irish. And for a very long time, people looked at them and said, "What in the world is that? Why does that exist?" In Irish, I'm not going to try to say the Irish because there may be someone listening, but it translates, the word for them is bell tower. So if people would actually just ask the Irish,
It would just be bell tower.
they're bell towers, but they're very tall, stone, round stone, conical shaped structures. And they actually, the doors would always be basically on the, we're talking to Americans, on the second floor.
Okay.
For those
Yes.
not American, it'd be the first floor. It's not on the ground.
Got it.
And so the remains of them obviously wouldn't have any way to get up
Right.
to it. So there was this idea that it was a place to go hide from the Vikings.
Oh.
So one person would grab all the valuables and there'd be a ladder you could climb up and then roll the ladder in and you could escape into the round tower and they wouldn't be able to jump into it. Which there's nothing saying it couldn't be used that way. I
Right.
personally wouldn't want to go in there because the stairs would have been wooden and that's a big chimney.
Because like what's stopping them from just
For just setting it on fire and then they can get the gold later, So,
as you know, they did at times.
but that's another really great architectural feature, again, related to the church. We also have what are called souterrains, from the French. It's an underground passage related to sometimes these ecclesiastical sites, but also you do get them at a lot of what are called ring forts. I've mentioned these earlier. So ring forts were enclosed kind of farmsteads
Right.
that they had a ditch and a bank kind of surrounding where your maybe a couple of houses or one or two, depending on how big the ring fort is inside, and you'd keep your livestock in there. And then if you were really powerful, you might have two banks and two digits,
Oh.
or sometimes three banks and three digits.
That's how you know
Basically,
that you were loaded.
yes, if you can afford to get that many people working for you to make
Exactly.
it was a show of power. But they'd have these underground passages that, again, people would be like, well, these were obviously places of refuge. You go and hide, and you could easily cover up the top and the Vikings or whoever, whatever raiding party, because the Irish were raiding each other as well.
Right.
You could go and hide. And there is definitely a lot of merit to that. Some of these have like trick passages, or they'd have places where they would suddenly narrow and then get wider again. And there's some evidence of kind of places where you could safely set a fire so you could stay warm down there. But they also would have been used for storage. So keeping your butter and things cold because it's underground.
Right,
I
that
mean, it
makes
doesn't
sense.
exactly get sweltering here, but it still would be, when it
Right.
does get, say, 70 degrees,
Oh,
you had
scorching.
a cooler place to keep your things. And yeah, so we have souterrains. Some potentially were paths of you could get out the other end. But usually there is an end to it. So those were definitely some of them used for escaping raiders, such as the Vikings, but also your next door neighbor who wants your cows.
Right, because cattle
Because
raids.
cattle was king.
Yeah, anyone just has to go look at, I mean, half of the known Irish literature that's just the cattle raid of blah, 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 to just kind of see that. What I find really interesting, though, is how much emphasis historians have kind of put on like raiding, especially like this might be used for fear of. It's always like the looming specter of Vikings coming to raid, which, I mean, if you're living in Ireland or England and like the 10th or 9th century, yeah, I guess this is a very scary prospect that is
Well,
happening.
and like I said, it wasn't just the Viking. Now,
Right.
usually there wasn't quite as much of the, kill everybody, especially
Right.
monks. Like the
Yeah.
Irish didn't necessarily raid their own monasteries
That's
because
good.
those were holy people. They didn't do that. The Vikings, however, didn't
Didn't
care.
care.
So that was kind of this like, oh no, they're
Right.
willing to do so much more than we are. Like they're so much worse. It's like they're just targeting different people.
Right. Like y'all are still targeting each other, but just not the monks.
And a lot of the raids in Ireland, from what we understand, was more just trying to get each other's cattle.
Right.
And occasionally you'd take slaves. And occasionally you'd take hostages, which were essentially, you know, if you treat us nice, we'll treat your little boy nice.
Right.
And sometimes the hostages were also exchanged on purpose. Of, if you stop raiding us, you can have my son. Kind of situation. Or we agree to whatever. Raiding was definitely a part of it. And I mean, you even see it in the law tracts, the Brehon laws in Ireland. They talk about, you know, recompense for stealing of different things. How much is a slave worth? How much is a woman worth? How much is... It's usually always compared to the cow. Again, cow's really important.
Right.
Really, cows are really
just important. Very, 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 very important.
I mean, you get dairy products and you get... Oh my, your internet connection is unstable. I'm sorry if I go in and out. I am in a different country.
No, you're totally fine. You haven't done any kind of like crackly yet, so knock on wood.
Okay, good. No, I got a notification.
Okay.
But yeah, what were we talking about?
Cows.
Got distracted.
Cows. Why cows are important.
So yeah, you get dairy, you get meat, and it makes sense that they are important. You know, a lot of the livelihood is centered on having cows.
Now I'm assuming they also use like cow fat, cow hide, all that stuff. Like just
oh yeah, they use the whole thing.
So like you're all getting
I mean,
so
you have
much from
most
one
of the
cow.
Manuscripts.
Oh really? Are cow skin?
Are on vellum, which
yeah,
is
yeah.
Cowhide.
That
usually
is
usually baby cows.
Oh.
And by usually I mean I'm pretty sure that's what they used.
Oh. That's really sad.
And it took a lot of cows to make one book.
So
but again,
okay,
you're
so
also probably you're also feeding people. So
right. So how much is a book compared to like everyone else, I guess? Because like damn, you have a book that's worth like let's say 17 baby cows.
But if it's the church doing it, then you handing over whatever you have to the church
right
helps ensure your path to heaven.
I see. Yep, that makes sense.
And actually, the Gaelic lords in particular, and somewhat with the Anglo-Normans, but the Gaelic lords, they actually would invest more of their income to the church than, say, the Anglo-Normans would. So they, like, the castles and everything that the Anglo-Normans brought over, especially at the beginning, the Irish were just still pumping their money into the church. Because if you got to say, look how wonderful the church in my area is, that's how you showed off your wealth.
Right.
Whereas the Anglo-Normans were like, look how awesome my castle is to show off their wealth. They still obviously patronized the church, but the Gaels were very much focused on, look how awesome my church is.
That's...
And so a lot of money and a lot of resources went to the churches.
Which makes me question, when exactly was Ireland Christianized? Like, what is like the rough date that people like to throw around versus what's
so
like the actual date?
We like to say around 400 AD, because there are some very late 4th century possibly saints. Saint Patrick is usually said to have come in 432. So some people say that Christianity started in 432.
Right.
There's
But
evidence that there was some earlier things happening.
Well, that makes sense.
But yeah, so around kind of that turn of the 5th century is when Christianity starts coming over. And it's not to say, obviously, the Irish knew about Christianity before then. Because Christianity had already reached all over the continent. It had reached
It was starting to spread.
The Irish weren't exactly, you know, not talking to people. They had ships. They went back and forth. Actually, I brought up Alm earlier, that the language, for those who don't know, it's a language of lines that are carved into stone. Typically, they just say somebody, son of somebody,
right,
kind of thing. But that was actually invented by an Irish tribe living in Wales.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So, and then they brought it back over. So it's, they very much, they were not isolated. They knew Christianity existed.
I do
But it
love
wasn't
how.
until really the early fifth century
Yeah.
that we started really seeing Christianity become a force in Ireland.
Okay. Because, like, I also love how I've been pronouncing Ohm wrong this entire, my entire 30 years of living.
People pronounce it Ogham as well.
Okay, because I've just like I have grown up hearing Ogham because I am from
Yeah.
the States. And for all of you that don't know what we keep talking about, if you've picked up a, like any kind of New Age book that's like Irish fortune telling runes, there you go.
Yeah.
That's it.
Harry, the new Harry Potter Legacy video game has Om in it. Not sure why, but it's there. So
Oh.
if you see scratches going up the side of some of those stones, actually, my partner was the one who, he was like, "Hey, is that what I think it is?"
That's really interesting because for most, whenever someone you like wants to do like magic European language, they almost always will stick with like Eldest
Runes.
Lutharc and just like
Yeah.
with a runic and just be like, this is the runes. They have, it's a magical language. And it's like, that just says the name Frank.
Well,
Frank.
it's similar with Alm. Like,
Right. It's just, that's just,
it's just people's names. It's
that's
not
Colin.
necessarily magic.
Right. That's Colleen. See, I know, I don't get like, I've been Dua Lipa. I've been Dua Lingoing. I've been trying to like learn some Irish simply because. I
Hey,
mean,
Cillian Murphy used Irish in his Oscar speech, so I'm hoping that a bunch of people start trying to learn Irish now.
I'm half Irish. I might as well try and learn it.
There you go.
Because French didn't take. So just kidding. I am doing my dissertation in French technically. But so what I really also want to like bring up too is that a lot of times we, I guess, have this perception in like the general pop culture that the Christian conversion was like one day someone woke up, a king said, "You're all Christian now," and boom, everyone was Christian. And that's not how conversion works.
No.
Conversion is a slow and gradual process. And mainly, like, I'm talking more about Iceland, and mainly because I do a lot of Old Norse work, as you know. And one of the things that I really like seeing is how Christianity kind of started and how it kind of spread. And there's still some places where like it took root, but took root in a way that it merged with the existing culture. It wasn't just a, this is your culture now, you no longer get to do anything else. Because a lot of times it was like, listen, you can still have your winter festival, you can still have your spring festival, just call it Easter, call it Christmas, and go drink. And tithe to a church, you're good, you're golden. Which is a very simplistic way of viewing it still. But like, it wasn't always the, we brutally massacred every single pagan, because if they did that,
you wouldn't have any new converts.
we wouldn't have any new converts. Exactly. So like, so for Ireland, how was the like, so we kind of already talked about like when the like people have assumed the Christian conversion started. But how was the like larger conversion? Was it peaceful? Was it aggressive? Like, what about the archaeological record kind of shows how it went?
So obviously the early medieval period is a violent period anyway.
Right, yeah.
So if you're looking for interpersonal violence, you're not necessarily going to say, oh, this was because of conversion, or
Right.
this was Vikings, or this was a raid on another clan, or you're not going to necessarily know exactly why there is a arrow in someone's head. You're just going to know there's an
There's
arrow
an
in someone's
arrow.
head,
Yeah.
right? But for the most part, especially looking at kind of the historical evidence as well as the archaeology, it seems mostly to have been peaceful. Again, like you said, there was kind of, You just kind of lay Christianity out like a kind of general blueprint, and then tweak it to fit what's there, you know? So a lot of the old gods became saints. One of my favorite saints, Saint Brigid, is thought to be a Christianization of a pagan goddess. There's also some evidence of a historical Brigid.
Ooh.
But kind of, you know,
Yeah.
some of the aspects of the saint were certainly, even if she was a historical figure, the hagiographies definitely grab on to some of the aspects of the
Oh,
goddess.
yeah.
And you know, a lot of the saints, even the ones that we are like, yes, it's a historical figure, their hagiographies are like, yeah, but what if we incorporate this really awesome kind of pre-Christian idea and put it in there? And yeah, like you mentioned, the holidays, you know, very much centered around what are you already doing
Right.
that we can just say, okay, but do that now for God, the
Right.
Christian God, instead of what the reason you were using beforehand. So for instance, February 1st, St. Bridget's Day.
Right.
Also Imbolc.
Right. Happens right around the
You
same
know,
day.
we're already partying,
Might as
but
well
we'll,
just.
you know, a saint died that day, so it's really important. So yeah, there was already a blueprint that Christianity kind of worked with,
Right.
and there kind of doesn't seem to be a whole lot of convert or die. There obviously were martyrs
Of
because we
course,
have
yeah.
plenty of saints,
Right.
and that's how you make a saint. But even like I mentioned earlier, Ireland kind of still did its own thing for a
Yeah.
very long time. We had the Benedictine or Gregorian Reformation in the 12th century. Well, it started in the 11th century and had the first actual mo Cistercian monastery in the 12th century here. And that kind of went, wait a minute, guys. You can't be Irish Catholic. You have to be Roman Catholic. And so in, especially in the more Anglo-Norman
Right.
areas, East Coast kind of situation, in Leinster, Dublin area,
Yeah.
they went, yeah, okay, we can be celibate. you know, things like that.
Yeah.
But in kind of the more Gaelic areas in the West and everything, they're like, eh, do we really need to do that? Is that like a thing we have to? And it took a while, basically, for it to
Right.
kind of spread. And again, there are still saints that are Irish saints, not Roman Catholic saints.
Interesting.
Now, obviously, a modern day Catholic pope, yes,
Right.
but wasn't so big of a deal in late medieval
Yeah.
Ireland. It was kind of a they had to use reform to say, look, we're
Yeah.
supposed to be listening to this guy over there.
Although, even though today there is some, we'll call it tension, polite tension, which is a very nice way of saying it, between Roman Catholics and Irish Catholics. We'll say some polite tension. We'll just leave it as that. I just want to just point out from my earlier generalization that while I said yes, some of it was peaceful, and like you said, there were, of course, very violent, very aggressive conversion tactics. But I do want to just make it clear to everybody that, like, there's a lot of. I'm gonna try not to make any enemies here, but I'm probably going to. There's a lot of like ahistoricism that happens with a lot of new age spots online that like to claim like histories about conversion. That's just not true. Like, my favorite is the Burning Times, one of my favorite myths. That didn't happen. Not the way you're thinking it happened. if anyone was, I mean, people were burnt at the stake for witchcraft, but that was a very largely a late medieval thing. And most people getting burned at the stake in places were not witches, but were in fact Jewish people. And it was more anti-Semitism than it is ye old witch cult. Good old Margaret, what's her name? But also want a small note on, like, since we are recording this on St. Patrick's Day, right?
St. Patrick's Day is tomorrow.
It's tomorrow. I was like, I know it's this weekend. And Easter is Tuesday. No, wait, no, the spring equinox is Tuesday. Easter, I think, is next Sunday.
March 31st is Easter.
Okay, so 2 Sundays from now. I don't know. We're in the like spring holiday trifecta season now. There's always the like Easter was actually stolen from the Mesopotamian goddess. No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. Okay, so the venerable Bede, love him or hate him, wrote about Ostara in one of his works, and that is quite literally the only place she has ever showed up, aside from maybe like something. And people have, like, etymologists have theorized that if she was existed, she might have been a pre-Indo-European dawn goddess. However, I think it was Bede that was like, the Anglo-Saxons have a festival of her around Easter or something like that. But I'm pretty sure she's not. I don't want to say she's not real because that will offend someone. But she was written about by Bede, but not she's not Ishtar.
For anyone who is thinking, oh, but Bede was definitely a reliable source. He also talked about peacocks in Ireland. I don't know if anyone knows this, but there are no peacocks in Ireland. There never have been. Well, at the zoo. They are at the zoo. But he talked about them being wild.
Where was he going? Where was he looking at? Because it wasn't Ireland.
I don't know.
Now, see, now I
He
have to Google Astara so I don't get it wrong.
But yeah, Bede came up in my research as well. He mentions the use of a type of shellfish to create a purple similar to Tyrian purple, which is made out of a shellfish in the Mediterranean called a murex shell. Or that's the species or the genus, technically. And here it's. I can't remember the Latin name. It's a dog whelp. Oh, I can't remember the Latin name. Oh, I hope no one in academia is listening to this.
I believe in you. You can do it. You
I can't.
can.
Anyway, dog whelp here. And while the dog whelp can 100% be used to make the dye, bead was, they're very, very small. It takes hundreds to make a useful amount. But bead is cited repeatedly in people who are talking about it being used and being used and being used. And it's like, because he's the only historical, like that old of a source that mentions it in Ireland. And it's like, there is a little bit, there is evidence, there is in fact evidence that it was used potentially in the early medieval. But quoting bead to me just makes it. I'm just like, no, you can't rely on this man.
Like, okay, I know that some people are like, he did do careful research on, okay, sometimes, but then sometimes he'll just say things and we're supposed to just go along with it, even
I
though.
mean, that's what histories were back then. It was also a
Exactly.
story.
Right. Like, it is a story. And the way I look at it from someone who has done a lot of research with especially mythology and folklore and all that fun jazz is that a lot of times these old medieval, like especially early medieval works, would use paganism to kind of justify Christianity in a weird way, or vice versa. Like thinking about Snorri's very, very weird idea of the Norse gods being Roman first, and you Himmerized into gods. And Ragnarok being a not even a subtle rewrite of Revelation, it parallels. So it could have just been Bede being like Easter, ooh, like trying to appeal
It could be this
to
thing.
whoever was still pagan, or maybe Ostara actually existed as a folklore. We just
Yeah, I
don't really
mean,
know. It could she could have, however. Easter is not a festival for Ishtar. And that's just something I need people to understand. I fully, because they also put that picture that gets mistaken for Lilith too up there. They're like, this is the Easter goddess. I was like, that's a bird lady. that's Ishtar, Lilith, maybe. I don't know. That's a lot that I don't feel like researching right now. But to the too long didn't read is you shouldn't take Bede's words as 100%, or really any kind of person who is writing that kind of history as 100%. There's
I
a
mean,
grains of truth.
technically, you shouldn't take any piece of
Right.
writing at face value.
Yes.
Read everything critically,
Yes.
but especially medieval histories, which, they're not trying to
No.
tell to be 100% factual. That was not their purpose.
Mm-mm.
Historians today are a different,
Right.
it's just different. So you need to read everything critically. Do not just assume because it happened in ye old times that, oh, we don't need to fact check this.
Right.
Fact check everything.
Right.
Just do it.
Because a lot of times stories were just that, stories. And sure, we could always look at like stories and myths always have like a tiny grain of truth somewhere in them. However, their biggest part was to help explain what was going on, but also a lot of times to to give a fantastical account of their own history, which is something that we also do today. Like we always look like if we exaggerate now, do you not think Mr. Bede was
Oh, yeah.
exaggerating in his little workshop? Of course he was. But I think we got really off topic there.
We did, yes.
Okay, so we have a few more minutes. Carrie, is there anything you want to talk about? Anything you want to bring up?
Well, I mentioned the date of 1169
Yes. Let's
between
circle
the
back.
early and late medieval, or some people say the high medieval. Really important date, and it's actually kind of with St. Patrick's Day tomorrow. That's kind of Ireland's national day. Yes, they have a Independence
Right.
Day basically, but really St. Patrick's Day is when they celebrate their nationality. And this, some people might have heard of the idea of 800 years of oppression of Ireland
Yeah.
under the English.
Right.
And that started in 1169.
Oh,
So
yeah.
there was the King of Leinster in the kind of middle of the 12th century was Dermot McMurrogh. And I'm going to be saying all of these names anglicized.
Yeah.
They do have proper Irish names, but we're going anglicized. So Dermot McMurrogh was the King of Leinster. He was deposed in 1169 by the High King of Ireland at the time, Rory O'Connor. So Dermot went over to England. And he went up to King Henry II and said, "Will you please help me get my kingship back?" And Henry said, "I give you permission to, use my people, ask somebody for help, and my people, you have permission." So he ends up getting Richard de Clare, aka Strongbow, to agree to help him. In exchange, Strongbow gets to marry his daughter Aoife. And so Richard de Clare sends a force in 1169. He's not with them, I'm pretty sure. They land at Benno Bay in County Wexford in the southeast and kind of start taking over from the southeast, moving north, kind of towards
Word.
Dublin in that area. Again, taking over Leinster, where Dermot McMurrogh, that's where his lands were. And Strongbow finally gets there in 1170. Henry II, the king himself, shows up in 1171 because obviously, if you're using my people, this is now
Right.
my land.
Oh
You have
no.
to swear fealty to me. And he brings along Hugh de Lacy, who's another really important figure, Anglo-Norman figure in Ireland. And Dermot died in 1171. So he had his lands back, or a good bit of his lands back for 2 years.
Oh.
And then Strongbow becomes king of Leinster, kind of because he married Aoife, but also just because people twisted the law so that he could succeed. Because really, Aoife shouldn't have been. Dermot had two wives and had plenty of
Oh.
children, but one of his wives only had Aoife, and so they said, well, she's the only wife that is actually his real wife, and so there are no other people to take charge. It's complicated, but basically, in other words, Strongbow becomes king of Leinster.
Right.
And this kind of sets up again, there's now two cultures
Yeah.
in Ireland. You have the Anglo-Norman culture, the Irish
Right.
culture. They speak different languages, they have different laws, different social systems, different agricultural practices.
Ooh.
Eventually, you do get the Anglo-Irish, who, once you get the plantations in the Tudor period
Yeah.
under, Henry, especially Elizabeth. Oh, Elizabeth loved her plantations. But at that point, actually, the Anglo-Irish are called the Old English because basically they've become Irish. There's a phrase that comes up a lot, kind of jokingly, that invaders come over to Ireland and then become more Irish than the Irish. And that's what they did. And the old English, the Anglo-Normans, do eventually actually fight back with the New English for a good portion. But that invitation of Dermot McMurrogh
Right.
was the beginning of English occupation in Ireland. And they brought over, again, there was a huge shift in agriculture. First, they had the Mott and Bailey, which is, so the Mott is a raised area, artificially raised
Yeah.
area, first with a wooden keep, but then eventually a stone keep. And then the Bailey is a walled courtyard area for
Right.
protection. And then once they got really settled, that's kind of the on the move castle. Once they got settled, they started building large continental castles.
Yeah.
This is really the first time we see large scale stone castles at all. So there's still some standing. Trim Castle in County Meath up near Dublin was built by de Lacy. Carrickfergus in County Antrim is another one still standing, built by John de Courcy, another early arrival. And there's plenty of Anglo-Norman castles around. And then I mentioned also there was kind of a revival in the Gaelic lords when the Anglo-Normans got distracted with their problems over in Britain, and with their Norman kind of fellows in France. There was a lot of things that just went wrong for them away from Ireland in the 14th century, which was a good distraction for the Gaelic lords to come up. And then we get the kind of Gaelic response
Yeah.
to the castles, which are tower houses. They're kind of small, usually about 4-story stone structures, really, really thick walls. Obviously, they're intended for defense. They weren't necessarily, your all year home, but if you were under threat, you'd go in there. And they were highly defensible, kind of the Gaelic response to the big old tower houses, but they were really only, one big room
Oh,
per floor kind of
just a giant
space.
room.
I mean, with the different floors, but
Right.
yeah. And you had intramural rooms, so inside the walls you'd have some of the smaller rooms and all
Right,
of your
that makes
staircases
sense.
and everything. So the most famous tower house is Blarney Castle.
Oh, okay.
Which is actually a really kind of fancy tower house.
Oh.
It's just up the road from me. I've kissed it like 4 times.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that y'all kissed that.
So so yeah, really big shift. There
Ooh.
were previous invasions. Obviously, you had the Norse
Right.
invasion with the Vikings.
Yeah.
Again, the Vikings came over. They went, hey, I kind of want to actually settle here instead of just pillage. Why don't we set up trade towns? And they set up our first towns. And then you had the the Norse Irish Gaelic Norse communities that came out of that. And then once they had settled and they're now just Irish You don't really, they're not separate, they're just Irish. Then the Anglo-Normans come over, and it's a huge shift that ends up having
Yeah.
repercussions for the next 800 plus years.
I mean, it sounds like it because just hearing you say how much the architecture dramatically changed, but in doing that, the landscape also changes.
Yeah, so you have they kind of separated the land very differently.
Right.
So the Anglo-Normans had a very kind of clustered idea of how you set up like
Right.
villages and things, whereas especially the rural Gaelic communities very spread out. You know, it just made more sense for how they handled agriculture and their society and how they intermingled and everything. And obviously there was differences in just agricultural practices, which agriculture really big deal in Ireland. Don't know if
Yeah.
anyone's heard about that, but it is. And it's been that way for a very long time. But there were new practices that came in with the Anglo-Normans. They started doing different crops just in general. They obviously there was actually kind of for the first time this idea of a cash crop. You're not necessarily planting it so that you can harvest and eat it
Right.
and kind of within your community. It was you're planting it to sell it. And so there was more land used
Right.
specifically for agriculture because you needed, you know, what you're feeding yourself with plus your cash crops.
Right.
And that was again a very new shift in the way things are done. One of the things that so there's a bane of Irish archaeologists of rabbit burrows in
Oh,
anything earthen at all.
yeah,
Rabbits are not native to Ireland. They're
really?
invasive species brought over by the Anglo-Normans to hunt. Hares are native to Ireland.
Okay,
Hares do not bother our archaeology.
but
And
bunnies
bunnies are
do,
cute. Rabbits are very,
right? I
very
love a
cute. They
bunny.
are precious. They are a life on this world, but they are invasive to Ireland.
I
And
had
they are
no.
destructive.
Because they burrow and they will burrow anywhere, really, and
Yeah.
eat any kind of crop they want to.
I mean,
Oh, yeah, I could see how
they're.
that would be bad. Yeah, I can see how that'd be
Yeah.
real bad.
But there was also the introduction of what are called deer parks. So you start getting areas dedicated to housing your hunting deer. And they brought over new deer. And actually, one of the interesting things I found in my research for this time period is you stop finding deer bones in the shell middens. Previously, you found them all the time. But late medieval, when there's actual laws against poaching of deer, and obviously the Anglo-Norman lords are the ones who own the deer, you stop getting deer bones in the middens. You get bones of other things, plenty
But
of cow
not deer
bones, etc.
bones.
No deer.
That's
So
very telling,
it's really
actually.
it's interesting seeing
Yeah.
kind of because obviously we have the historical records talking about the
Right.
bringing in of all these things, but we also have the archaeology is very much reflect and the different pieces of archaeology, you know, the
Yeah.
deer parks you see on a landscape level, and then you actually see there seems to actually be a shift in what's showing up in the archaeological record. So yeah.
Yeah.
And since we're running out of time, just
Yes.
one of the really
Go
interesting
for it.
things that I found with historical records versus kind of popular understanding.
Right.
Not necessarily archaeology didn't necessarily say that either was wrong, but the way the historical record and popular understanding kind of clash was really
Yeah.
interesting to me. In the late medieval, we start finally getting things like cookbooks and accounts of household accounts of like what they're ordering for food, right? What they're actually
Oh.
eating in the high-end, fancy, well-to-do
Right.
places. And late medieval and post-medieval going into that, we have all of these records, which very clearly show that the aristocracy, for lack of a better word, are most certainly eating shellfish.
Really?
Mussels, oysters, scallops. They don't typically go for the
Yeah.
limpets and the winkles, but I mean, mussels are just as easy to grab.
Right.
And they're everywhere, in the accounts. And you do get in the cookbooks, you still get the stuff for how to do winkles and limpets, especially limpets. So they're there. They're in these higher end places. But there's actually a term in Irish, kind of still sometimes used today, to refer to shellfish that translates as poor man's food. And so there was this kind of
Yeah,
cognitive dissonance between what's actually happening and what people think was happening.
right. Like I've heard that, like even in the states that like lobster and shellfish was poor man's food. But hearing you say that there are cookbooks that we know from the record that rich people are eating mussels and
Yeah, we have
shellfish.
household accounts. There was one that even, I think there was a suggestion, I can't remember exactly,
Right.
but basically it was suggested that oysters in particular were a favorite of this particular lady. She just loved them so much.
Good for
And
her.
like oysters obviously do take a little bit more to get to,
Yes.
but poor people can still go out on their little curraghs,
Right.
their little tiny boats, and get oysters. And at low tide, there's species of oysters you can get just by walking into the low tide. So it's very interesting, and that has to do with going into the perception of what happened during the
Right.
famine.
Yeah.
So there is more historical background going on,
Right.
but it's very interesting that the famine very much had this shift in how people understand shellfish. Now we're back to the fishmonger asked a lot for their shellfish now. We're back to
Right. Right.
that.
Because I'm paying an arm and a
It's
leg.
no longer reserved for the poor people.
Right.
But yeah, there was definitely, and that's why it's so important, I think, for historians and archaeologists to work together, and
Yeah.
historians to not, obviously ethnographies are great for understanding how people, talking to people
Right.
while I was doing surveys and stuff, there is value to how they perceive these deposits and shellfish and everything. But how does that fit into the actual narrative? What was
Right.
actually going on? And you need every little piece that you can get. Because as we talked about, the historical record is faulty. The
Yeah.
archaeological record is missing a bunch of pieces. So,
So we gotta
when you basically have a giant jigsaw.
Right.
Historians have about 5 out of 1 billion pieces. Archaeologists have about 5 out of 1 billion pieces. Together,
Right.
we have 10 pieces, which gets us a little bit closer.
Right. Slowly but surely, we're getting
But
there.
separate, we still we don't have anywhere
Right.
close to the full picture.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's definitely kind of bringing that all together. You need the historical side of things, the literary
Yeah.
side of things, and the archaeology to really
To
understand what's going
form
on.
like the corner of the picture.
Yeah, exactly. We might get
Right.
close to an edge,
To an edge. And we'll get there maybe one day. But I think that's a good place to kind of end this on. Carrie, is there anything that you want to promote? Anything that you have going on that you want to?
I hopefully have a talk coming up in the next EAA session, but
Nice.
otherwise I'm just focused on work right now. No seminars or anything coming up. If anyone in Ireland's listening, give prismproject.ie a look. Preserving the record of Irish shellmans.
You know what? Someone here in the States might want a look at that. So I will, you know what? I'll link that in the show notes.
Okay, yeah, it's a cooperative project that myself and another shellman researcher here in Ireland trying to get people to kind of look at their own backyard and what's there.
Oh, that is very cool. And of course, you all know that to like and subscribe if you haven't already, and give me a review unless it's mean, because if it's mean, I will cry. So, on that note, thank you everyone for listening, and I will see you all next time. Okay, I think I can.